Hi, everyone. Welcome to Waste 360's Nothing Wasted podcast. On every episode, we invite the most interesting people in waste, recycling, and organics to sit down with us and chat candidly about their thoughts, their work, this unique industry, and so much more. So thanks for listening and enjoy this episode.
This session is the first session of a dual session on PFAS. My name is Steve Menoff. I'm with Civil and Environmental Consultants in Pittsburgh. I'll be the moderator for this session. So we're going to do this as an interactive session with our panel. And we also will welcome, you know, audience participation as you have questions or comments that you would like to add as well. There's a microphone in the middle of the room. We'd appreciate it if you would go to the microphone, introduce yourself, name and affiliation, you know, if you have a question or a comment. So our panel this morning consists of three people and my supporter, who's the smartest person in the room. Joe Benko is the Director of Engineering for Republic Services. In this role, Joe supports the engineering department with all technical challenges regarding landfill construction, environmental remediation, compliance resolution, and regulatory strategy. Joe also serves as the Project Committee Chair for the Environmental Research and Education Foundation, and in that role is in large part responsible for directing a lot of the research on PFAS. So we appreciate that support. Joe holds a Bachelor of Science degree in Civil Engineering from the University of Notre Dame and is a registered professional engineer in several states. Sam Nicolai is Vice President of Engineering and Compliance for Casella Waste Systems, a regional solid waste recycling and resource management services company headquartered in Rutland, Vermont. He leads the team that manages the company's engineering, permitting, construction, and environmental compliance programs at solid waste facilities throughout Casella's Northeast footprint. His expertise includes developing technical and financial solutions for complex environmental management systems, including facility development, environmental monitoring programs, and risk management strategies. His nearly 25 years of industry and consulting experience includes managing engineering, EHS compliance, and due diligence programs for a wide variety of solid waste and industrial facilities. Sam holds a civil environmental engineering degree from the University of Virginia and Virginia Tech University, and again is a licensed professional engineer in several states. David Pepper is currently the Vice President of Post Collections for GFL Environmental. He has over 35 years of experience in the solid waste industry, working primarily in the area of landfill development and operations. In this capacity, he has been involved in all elements of landfill operations, including permitting, construction, daily operations, environmental monitoring compliance, as well as landfill gas energy project development. David is also involved in transfer station permitting and development, along with other development projects. He currently serves as GFL's representative to the NWRA Board of Trustees. He is also a research council member for the Environmental Research and Education Foundation, a member of the NWRA Landfill Institute, and has served as the chapter chair for the Carolinas chapter of NWRA. Stephanie Bolliard is a research engineer as well as a courtesy professor at Florida State University. In 2021, she was a Waste 360 40 Under 40 recipient. Prior to joining North Carolina DOT, she was a research and scholarships program manager at the Environmental Research and Education Foundation for 5 years. Dr. Bolliard received her PhD and MS in Environmental Engineering at the University of Central Florida. She has 14 years of academic and professional experience in domestic wastewater permitting, environmental compliance, solid waste management, and nanotechnology. Her research expertise, including solid waste management, analytical chemistry, advanced spectroscopic techniques, biological and advanced oxidation processes, domestic wastewater treatment, and nanotechnology. Before we get into PFAS specifically, I think it's interesting how these compounds affect our lives without us being aware of it or thinking about it on a regular basis. So if I can ask the panelists to kind of talk about the first time they encountered PFAS either in their personal life or professional life and what it subsequently led to?
I think PFAS for me really, it probably hit me most on cleanup issues. Part of what I deal with is our remedial and our Superfund portfolio for the company. And so we had an issue where it became a contaminant of concern within an existing groundwater treatment and remediation system. And really watching that unfold kind of in a state where there was a very high level of focus because of a specific cleanup that was occurring. We were very much adjacent to that from an issue perspective, but the state was already on high alert in terms of how they wanted to deal with it. And so the challenge we had really was it going very quickly from just a groundwater cleanup, which can be a fairly narrow regulatory focus. You know, it's just, all right, we're gonna run a groundwater pump and treat, and we've got geologists local to the state that are overseeing that, to a much larger issue when, you know, if there are water wells nearby and there's a local health department that has to get involved, how do the different regulatory bodies within the state talk to each other about how they're gonna, you know, work together to solve the problem? And then also, how are they counseling some of the other public health agencies that are out there? And, you know, it was a challenge for us because I think it was still early in the process and there wasn't a lot of guidance and collaboration on how to solve the problems. So really that's kind of when I first saw that, and that was probably 4 or 5 years ago now.
I guess for me personally, I don't know that I have a personal account of realizing that my microwave popcorn bag was contaminating my children. But from a professional standpoint, we operate in several states across the country, and in one of those states there was a major manufacturer of these chemicals that hit the radar and the local news, and then you started tracing the tentacles of their involvement in all things across the community at large. And that's kind of what really kind of raised the bar for us to realize that, you know, what PFAS was and, you know, how it works and how ubiquitous it is across the community.
Yeah, maybe on a more products level, certainly in some of the Northeast states, we had some early manufacturing facilities that did remediation, and so we heard what PFAS was. But Northeast, certainly big ski country, and one of the early products that was identified that had significant concentrations of PFAS was ski wax. And so, you know, sort of a niche industry, not a ton of ski wax produced, but certainly we saw that fairly early, and I've seen my first PFAS-free ski wax product, you know, on the shelves. I think someone said earlier they've seen their first PFAS-free pan that you can buy at the store, and we saw a photograph of the first PFAS-free milk sitting in the grocery store. So those have really hit home. I think what we've all known academically, that these are all products that we're using in our day-to-day lives, but really now we're seeing that hit home with these little stickers you're seeing in the grocery stores and in the retail stores.
Stephen, you good? I think just kind of to frame the discussion is, you know, what's the magnitude of the issue? What's the public health risk? What's the risk to the environment as we go through these slides and talk about this? You know, I just think about all the daily products, you know, we use and take for granted, and we as a society expect a lot of things, and we don't always want to pay the price for them. And what is the price? Is there a significant risk price? You know, I always remember that line, better living through chemistry. But Gore-Tex, Teflon, Resolve Carpet Cleaner, Stainmaster, I mean, everything that we kind of take for granted, we don't think about it. And then we come to these kind of conferences and we deal with these products on a facility basis with regulators, and we don't always link the two and, you know, how they affect our life and how we deal with them professionally. So what are PFAS? PFAS refers to a large group of synthetic compounds that comprise a chain of linked carbon and fluorine atoms. The main categories are PFOA, I'm not going to mispronounce that, PFOS, and Gen X. Commonly used surface treatment applications, paper, fabrics, cookware, carpeting, all the type of products we see on a daily basis detected everywhere. There's different lengths of carbon chains. We're seeing them go to shorter chain lengths in response to the regulatory requirements on some of the longer existing older compounds, and now we're trying to deal with those. This is kind of a snapshot history of PFAS and just kind of where they came from. In 1938, a research engineer, Dr. Roy Plunkett, working for DuPont, accidentally discovered Teflon during a failed experiment with refrigerator coolant. Subsequently to that, 3M wound up acquiring that rights. So they ultimately sold it back to DuPont. In the 1940s, PTFE, Kevin can pronounce this, I can't, polytetrafluoroethylene was used in nonstick coatings. PFOS, PFOA soon followed, you know, in that regard. It took DuPont 10 years of research to finally bring DuPont bring Teflon to the market in 1949. So the initial use that they talked about for this nonstick compound was to coat military weapons in World War II to protect them from opposing shells, but I don't think that was ever actually put into use. DuPont bought the rights to PFOA, which 3M referred to as C8 because it was eight carbons, to use in Teflon and other products as the sole manufacturer. In the 1950s, DuPont began manufacturing PFAS in West Virginia and found buildup in the blood of some of the employees. In the 1960s, the US Navy began using PFAS compounds to develop firefighting foams. To this day, that's one of the major uses of these compounds is firefighting foams. Also in the 60s, studies began to show health effects on lab animals. In the early 70s, DuPont did a study that showed liver damage from exposure to PFAS in food packaging. And in 1978, they discovered C8 in human blood. It progresses. There were eye defects found in lab rats, several people who lived near the plant in West Virginia. And I guess I'll ask the question. There were two movies. One was a documentary. One was a based on real life movie, Dark Waters. I forget the name of the documentary. Kevin, you remember?
The Devil We Know.
What?
The Devil We Know.
Correct. Thank you. I don't know if anybody's seen those. They did a fact check on the movie version, you know, the fictional version, and it actually came out better than most of these type of things. The only things they really found as issues were some of the personal life issues of the main characters. So the basic story of what happened and the lawsuits seem to be pretty realistic. In the 1980s, DuPont would dump this C8 contaminated waste into a West Virginia landfill in the Ohio River. It was found in local drinking water in 1984, and subsequently to that, it was found in samples in local blood banks. Ultimately, this led to a number of lawsuits, which DuPont settled. In most cases, they changed the compound and continued manufacturing the products. So Teflon, et cetera, Gore-Tex are still. This gives an overview of the PFAS life cycle from its generation, production, through product manufacturing, through its implementation, and ultimately through its place in the waste management system. Number of ways of emissions are through air, soil, and water, exposure through workers, consumers, and the environment. It's out there on a daily basis. The persistence of the CF bonds and the prevalence of these bonds in the products that we use makes it very difficult to destroy, which is the major problem facing the solid waste industry as we try to manage it. So this again shows the life cycle and, you know, how we begin to play a role with our solid waste infrastructure through the industry. We see the producers, you know, industrial PFAS then used by manufacturers to turn into products. The users are those who actually make the products, the consumers, we who buy them and use them. Fire departments, again, that's a major use, but the military uses it for quite a bit of firefighting applications as well. And then ultimately, after these products are used, they get thrown away. So they wind up in wastewater treatment plants, they wind up through land application of sludges from wastewater treatment plants into plants, agriculture, and ultimately they wind up in the waste management system, which means they wind up going through our system of collection companies, transfer station, MRFs, and wind up in landfills. They can be composted. Incineration was seen as an answer briefly. Now there are a number of incineration bans at multiple levels. Landfills play a major role in sequestering these, and we'll talk about that more as we progress. And then ultimately, the ones that don't go directly to a wastewater treatment plant through product disposal, they wind up going there through leachate from the landfills.
So it's important to understand what have we been dealing with in terms of addressing the PFAS issue. A lot of industry decisions, regulatory action is really going to rely on what do we know about PFAS beyond these basics, specifically for the solid waste industry. So we've categorized the state of knowledge in terms of what are some well-informed areas, where is research underway, and then what are some knowledge gaps relative to this overall challenge of dealing with PFAS at an industry level. So as we know, we have a good collection of analytical data. We know PFAS is in leachate. We know it's different across the landfill, depending on what waste you got, how you manage your landfill precipitation, all the things that we know, generally speaking, from a leachate characteristic standpoint of differences. We have some evidence of fate of PFAS in landfills, what comes in, what might happen. There's evidence of sequestration, which is great. And we have a good handle on PFAS and special industrial waste, and we've seen the prevalence of PFAS in food packaging and that hitting mainstream sources. Leachate treatment from a conventional standpoint, but some of the areas that are under research that are going to be important for us to really close the gap on and answer how the solid waste management infrastructure fits into managing PFAS is landfill liner performance, landfill gas characterization, thermal treatment. Those are two areas that are really relying heavily on needing analytical techniques to be able to answer some of those questions which are under development. The need for advanced leachate treatment methods, really understanding the question of if we want to get PFAS out of the environment, we need to have methods to be able to destruct PFAS, but is that can we get to that point, and what is that going to look like? And then, of course, management of treatment residuals from some of these emerging advanced technologies. I would like to highlight, as Steve mentioned earlier, EREF is playing a really key role in addressing these knowledge gaps, and they do have research addressing each one of these topics under the under research aspects, as well as some other agencies. But some of the important knowledge gaps to consider is what is really the relative contribution of human exposure to the solid waste industry relative to other areas, and where the regulatory effort is being focused. PFAS and recyclables is one of those areas we have not seen explored from the academic standpoint. And then to close the gap on the extent of PFAS sequestration, we have a good handle on those industrial special wastes and food packaging, but what is the mass flow coming in from our households, residential streams, that large fraction of waste that we're managing at our sites? But the key takeaway is that it's important to consider developing targeted and mindful studies that are addressing key areas to make informed management decisions, whether it's from an industry standpoint or from a regulatory standpoint. So delving into some of the topics that we'll discuss from an industry standpoint today and how our panelists have dealt with some of these topics. So leachate management treatment offsite. As you know, a majority of the landfills that are active are discharging to POTWs, about 60% right now. And the question is, what is the impact of landfill leachate on wastewater influent effluent is still an evolving topic. But from the studies that we've seen at the state level in North Carolina and Michigan, they had similar outcomes. Although leachate has a relatively higher concentration in some PFAS compounds relative to domestic sources, some of those studies have shown that there's a relatively minor contribution, specifically on PFOA and PFAS. And some of the peer-reviewed studies that have looked beyond PFOA and PFAS also supported that study that outcome. USGS did a study, as well as some of the studies in Australia, that have found overall it's a relatively minor contribution. But what's important to note too is that there are non-leachate sources from other industrial sources that can contain these compounds, and in some instances can have a greater mass contribution to those wastewater treatment plants. So looking at the context of leachate offsite treatment, it's important to understand the volumetric contribution not beyond just your PFAS concentrations. And the figure here shows outcomes of some of the statewide studies relative to that USGS study. And you know, looking at the leachate mass contributions, they were on the order of 10% or lower. And in some cases, even though we had PFOA coming in from landfill leachate, those concentrations of the influent were under non-detect levels, specifically in the case of the USGS study, the PFAS. So for looking at on-site treatments, and I do want to note here that we're talking about conventional off-the-shelf technologies that are field implemented and widely available. The next session will cover these more advanced treatment technologies, but proven technologies we've seen are reverse osmosis and some type of media adsorption. That's been shown to be successful at removing 90 to 99% of PFOA, PFAS in general. But the challenges there is on-site treatment is going to increase costs from an industry standpoint. And then also it can be challenging to get permits to discharge your effluent. And then also if you're generating some type of either solid or liquid stream after treatment, we have to consider what you're going to do with that as well. And then looking at our that unknown about the relative contribution for landfills in terms of PFAS overall exposure, the figure here shows you, if we're a landfill treating leachate, whether it's on-site or off-site at a POTW, that treated effluent is going to go in the environment. And if we're looking at degrees of separation from potential human exposure from drinking water, you know, we're looking at least 3 degrees of separation there, and that needs to be considered. And then we've seen a lot of talk about biosolids management and disposal. So really what happens in PFAS during wastewater treatment process, those wastewater treatment plants were designed for conventional treatment, not a carbon fluorine bond, which we've seen it increases the bond strength, it's harder to break down. So it's not surprising that we're seeing negligible removal in conventional wastewater treatment processes, but we're also seeing an increase in effluent concentrations due to the transformation processes and precursor degradation to terminal end products. So just a lot of things that are going on in that plant that can make it even more challenging to track. So the primary mechanism for any type of transport of PFOA in the liquid stream to the solid stream, we're seeing that associated with biosolids. And as you can see here on the right, it will be important in some of our questions to our panelists, is that 51% in 2019 of biosolids is going to land application, and that's going to be important when we talk about some regulatory changes. So looking at the PFAS basics, looking at what we know and what we don't know, there's a few considerations that we're going to highlight today and to think about. So really, what does the role of the solid waste infrastructure play in PFAS management relative to the known knowledge in the area of research? What's the science to address what that potential role looks like? Also important, how are regulations coming together to clarify that role? And then are we on the trajectory where the industry is able to, you know, meet whatever goals might be set from a regulatory perspective? So the first topic we talk about is the role of infrastructure and utilization challenges. So looking at biosolids disposal, land application, and landfilling, we see PFAS is associated with biosolids. We know about 51% in 2019 were land applied, but one thing I'd like to highlight is some states are banning. So Maine has a ban on land application of biosolids that was recently proposed and passed. Sam, what have you seen how potentially this ban could affect, you know, landfills, managing that, and just the management of biosolids in the Northeast?
Thanks, Stephanie. So yeah, it's been interesting. Maine has had some regulations around biosolids for the last 2 years or so. So we've had screening levels, essentially, where biosolid and biosolid-derived products were tested and had to meet a screening level. But then Maine decided in this legislative session, the most recent one, they reversed course, and they've gone to a full-out ban. So they've essentially banned the land application of biosolids and biosolid-derived products 100%. It was signed by the governor about 2 weeks ago, and will go into effect a little bit later this year. So I think the pie chart kind of shows it. I mean, that's a national number. That's not a Maine number. But nationally, 50% of all biosolids in this country are land applied, and 50% roughly go to landfills are incinerated. So Maine is fortunate, I guess, in that it has a little bit of a lower percentage that was land applied. So we're going to see those biosolids move likely pretty directly to landfills, either in the state or out of the state. We've had a lot of discussion, as have many in the state, about whether or not our landfill capacities are sufficient to handle more tons of biosolids. It's interesting to look at that compared to many other states which are desperately trying to get biosolids out of their landfills and save and manage that precious landfill airspace. So it's going to be a challenge. Obviously, we haven't even seen the implementation yet. That will go into effect starting this year. But we certainly expect that it's going to be a challenge for the facilities in Maine, and we're going to see that continued movement of waste that we see, you know, throughout the Northeast. It's, at least in my opinion, it's unfortunate. We recognize that for all intents and purposes, biosolids of this country, wherever they are produced, have some level of PFAS in them. That is basically found to be universally true. And so we have to have a strategy for them. We have to be able to manage them. But moving from a screening level approach, which looked at the science, to just an outright ban and hoping that we'll find solutions to put these somewhere else, doesn't seem like a prudent step. So we'll see Maine's experience, and but certainly other states are going to be looking at this and grappling with this over the coming months and years.
I would say just a little bit of a challenge too, in terms of, we talk about other states pushing sludge and biosolids out of the landfill. You know, there's a limited amount of capacity for it, not only from the perspective of are we going to preserve landfill airspace for other uses. The way a lot of MSW landfills are designed, you couldn't fill them 100% with sludge and have the slopes remain stable. So there becomes a challenge as well in terms of if we're going to quickly eliminate one whole option for biosolids, obviously the market may not be ready with alternatives.
So the other thing that Steve brought up too is that in terms of incineration, it was in the interim guidance for disposal of PFAS-containing waste, incineration was noted as an option. There are knowledge gaps, as similar to the wastewater treatment transformations, what the products of incomplete combustion would be and what operating conditions are optimized for destruction of PFAS. But Sam, how have you seen that perspective changed?
Yeah, there's absolutely this need for better research on the incineration. We know that you need some fairly high temperatures in order to properly destroy those carbon-fluorine bonds. We've been using incineration as an industry for the AFFF, the firefighting foam, for a while now. There was a facility in New York State that was accepting AFFF from, I think it was 25 states throughout the country, and incinerating them. New York actually passed a ban on that, essentially shutting that facility down because of concerns about the amount of deposition that was coming out from that incineration. And then if you've followed it all, trying to keep up, last week, the Department of Defense issued a memo essentially directing U.S. defense facilities to stop incinerating AFFF, period. Pending some further guidance as to what they're going to do with them. So at this point, we don't really have a strategy for what we're going to do with these dwindling stockpiles of AFFF. Plus, we don't really understand the incineration fully to even know whether incineration of lower levels is okay or not okay and the impact. So unfortunately, a lot of questions. But again, these regulatory bans are sort of the reaction and trying to find another solution to how to handle these materials.
And then on the remediation side, what has been your experience in the Northeast?
From a biosolids remediation, very little. There's a few companies out there that are working on it, trying to utilize technologies. I think as much as we're going to talk about leachate technologies in the second session, there's even less being done on, you know, the biosolid side. There are a few technologies that sort of look promising that, you know, maybe will have the ability to show some reduction. I mean, those would be game-changing technologies, being able to manage that. But at least from my perspective, they don't appear to be immediately implementable, and we're still a little bit of ways away from trying to figure that out. I think it's more likely that, you know, we're going to have, I don't want to call them classes, but you're going to have levels. You're going to have different levels in biosolids and compost from certain facilities than you are from other facilities based on where that facility is accepting waste and wastewater. And we're going to need to recognize that difference and be able to try to manage around them.
Okay, looking at, you know, leachate treatment and disposal, as we know, offsite treatment via POTWs is prevalent. And EPA has been focusing on expanding their studies on PFAS impacts from what are the impacts of leachate on wastewater, influent, effluents, and going beyond the PFOA and PFAS. You know, putting into perspective really what leachate impact is on POTWs and whether or not it's a significant contributor, we've seen evidence in the literature that due to the flow going into wastewater treatment plants, landfills are not considered a significant contributor. As David, have you seen POTWs potentially reacting prematurely to the talk about EPA Plan 15 and impacts of PFAS effluent guidelines?
Yeah, I think, I don't know, prematurely is a matter of opinion, right? Depends on your perspective, but certainly as Sam has described some of the activities in the Northeast around biosolids with EPA's guidance on, you know, the opportunity that landfills or incineration and deep well are kind of options for disposal at this point. It seems a little counterintuitive that, you know, wastewater treatment plants would then turn around and say, we're going to quit taking your leachate. Yet we've seen that happen in some jurisdictions where, in one instance in the Midwest, we've had, you know, one particular local wastewater treatment facility has many industrial users. And they have sent out a notice that they're basically shutting down their industrial user program in its entirety, not exclusive just to banning landfills from sending their leachate for as part of an industrial user permit, but we're also seeing, you know, that applied across the board, which brings to, you know, real interest this subject matter that we talked about earlier of how much mass does the average household generate when we look at the amount of flows from just our normal household municipal wastewater treatment. You know, we see the studies that indicate landfill leachates are 10% or less of the mass flow into any individual wastewater treatment plant. Yet you see a response like this where we're shutting down the entire user program, including, you know, major battery manufacturer that we all love to buy battery vehicles now, electric vehicles. There happens to be one of those in this particular jurisdiction. You know, what are they going to do with their wastewater from these facilities? So it's a challenge. It's certainly something that we've seen happen. And so far, we've been able to mitigate those risks. But it's part of the interest of why we're here and why we're talking about this subject is probably the biggest fear that we all face in the industry at this point. I think the other thing that's a challenge for the industry here is that, you know, we have certain technologies that are out there that are proven, and we find ourselves in a situation where we decide we want to go down that road as a facility, a solid waste facility, and we decide we want to implement some sort of on-site treatment to be able to clean up the PFAS and sequester it further in the landfill. And yet one department, in this case, in my example, the solid waste department is all excited about the opportunity for us to implement a particular treatment strategy, and yet the water quality people won't give you a permit to discharge the basically deionized water on the backside of the project that you have to add chemicals back into so that you don't kill the bugs in the stream because the water's too clean. So that's one of the things that we see happening as well from a challenging standpoint is just, you know, communication among the departments to make sure we're all equally aligned around the strategy. So that's some of those learnings that we're going through to try to get better as an industry and as a regulatory community.
And as David just mentioned, you know, the challenge of regulators, when we look at collectively across the U.S., we've seen an increase in state legislative efforts. In 2019, we had about 100 bills in place. 2020, we had over 180. But there's varying degrees of progress at each state level overall for that state agency, and there can be varying degrees within the same agency and the various units. As David just mentioned, the challenges of working between the solid waste and the water quality units. Looking at the map here, you know, we're outlining in teal where there's some form of state guidance. In yellow, the states chose to go with EPA health advisory levels. We have pending regulations in the dark gray, but it's important to note that despite all the attention on PFAS, there are some states that do not have current criteria, and it's not on the radar in the same degree for each of those states. So Sam, what is the status of the regulatory efforts in the Northeast?
So certainly, I think the Northeast has been many of the early adopters. There are a few other states, Michigan comes to mind, but there were early manufacturing facilities in Vermont, New Hampshire, and New York that were identified, and those remediation of those sites, I think, led the Northeast states a little bit more attention and a little bit more effort on the regulatory side. At this point, pretty much all of the Northeast states have groundwater, drinking water standards. Several of them have soil remediation standards now in place. Of course, Maine, we talked about from a biosolids standpoint. And at least three of them have surface water criteria that's expected to go into place in, I would say, the next, we'll call it 24 months or so. So I anticipate that for at least three of those states that I will have, you know, a surface water criteria requirement in surface water for PFAS to be able to discharge. And that will obviously affect everybody who discharges in those states. It's not limited to solid waste. I guess the other thing I would point out, and this is a very good thing, that most of those states also at this point have some kind of product-related ban. So they have either banned or set up some kind of schedule to ban the implementation or the use of PFAS in new manufactured products. So we're at least stopping the generation of these products from going into, or I should say stopping, we're slowing them down, at least the level of these products going into you know, our businesses, our homes. And certainly, you know, while not uniform, most of the states in the Northeast have gotten that. So certainly, there it continues to be a patchwork among the states, and I tell the story that there was a time at one point where I could have a glass of water containing PFAS in one state and it was hazardous waste, and I could take one step to the state next door and it was completely unregulated and I could drink that water depending on which side of the property line I was on. And so that patchwork continues, but certainly the regulations are becoming a little bit more uniform and making some progress there.
David, how have you seen the Southeast?
Yeah, I think you see, if you look at the map, it's more gray in the Southeast than in certainly Sam's area in the Northeast. So what we see happening from a regulatory standpoint primarily at this point is really a lot of surveys, a lot of testing to determine, you know, kind of what concentrations exist and where, and, you know, trying to be a little more, I hesitate to say thoughtful, because it insinuates that the Northeast is not thoughtful. That's not my intent, but, you know, I think there's a little bit more of a pause to let the science kind of catch up. I would say legislatively, there's been a tremendous amount of activity, not only in the Southeast, but across the country, And that's where we can get ourselves in real trouble on things like Maine, where legislatures start to drive things from whatever agenda they have, whether it be personal or otherwise, and that can put the regs out in front of the science for sure. Yeah, Michigan, I think, fits more along the lines Sam mentioned, you know, that it is more more like the Northeast than it is the rest of the Midwest. But certainly a lot of activities around quality standards for groundwater, stormwater, those sorts of things. So there's a tremendous amount of interest in this subject matter, and again, for lots of different reasons. Obviously, the city of Flint, as Sam mentioned, you know, you had some areas where states got engaged on these topics because of a particular issue, and that's where I think Michigan found itself. Is, you know, there was a public drinking water supply that was impacted by these types of chemicals, and so there was a tremendous interest and a lot of political interest in that subject matter, and so those states tend to be a little more aggressive and a little more out there in front.
So now backing into the federal regulatory efforts and kind of understanding what's going on at that, Joe, when thinking about federal PFAS policy actions, many will tend on to focus on EPA's efforts revolving around drinking water regulations. Are there any specific EPA policies underway that the solid waste sector should be specifically mindful of?
Well, I think, Stephanie, we've got some laid out here for sure that certainly we're watching carefully, and that is, you know, there's currently, as part of the overall PFAS Action Act that EPA, or PFAS Action Plan that EPA had rolled out, I mean, you'd seen EPA become engaged, and I think even the prior map, you saw a very varied level of response depending on where you were in the country. You saw states that, you know, are we would characterize as very far down the path in terms of trying to regulate in a series of multimedia. You saw states that by law are obligated to follow the federal regulations, whatever the federal regulations are, and you see states that just kind of haven't sorted it out yet in terms of maybe where, you know, three potential ways to characterize that difference. And it's kind of interesting to see that when you think about the fact that, you know, if you think about the way other things are regulated with the environmental community in which we live, I mean, we're all here together at this conference because EPA decided at a federal level some 30 or 40 years ago that they were going to change the way the solid waste industry was regulated. They promulgated regulations, rolled that out, and then delegated the authority to each of the states to implement that plan. And so what you see is a fairly consistent landscape across the different states of how we build a landfill and how we operate the landfill. Whereas where we sit right now in PFAS is a lot of differences, you know, to Sam's point, whether I step over a state line and what's in that glass of water is regulated one way versus another. And you know, it begs the upper, it underlies the point that, you know, certainly legislatively, people felt EPA was slow to step in and begin to regulate this. And so there was a lot of pressure and a lot of push from either the states or the legislatures to push for action. And so you've seen EPA roll out a bunch of things in the past few years to accelerate and kind of make that up. And so now they're working off their PFAS action plan to, you know, get out ahead of it and try to put some national scope over the many individual regulations. And EPA's got a bit of a challenge now because, you know, there's a bunch of different regulations that they sort of have to sort out and figure out contextually how they're going to put it together. But what EPA and the federal government does have are some very powerful tools and some very powerful regulations on how to organize it. And so certainly they're pursuing trying to do that with classifying PFAS as a CERCLA hazardous substance. So we've seen that become promulgated, and we know that that proposal has been sent from EPA to OMB and the White House for final review. So we're expecting at some point here, I, you know, I guess any day now, but any day now could be another couple of months, so don't quote me on it. But we should see some, or we're expecting to see some activity classifying PFAS as a hazardous substance. And so that helps pave the way for cleanup under CERCLA in contaminated groundwater and other opportunities. So certainly expecting that, waiting to see what the, you know, what the actual language is in the proposal. It's not public in its current form, so we definitely are waiting to see how that shakes out. You know, we're looking at the national effluent limits. We talked about this earlier. This is plan 15 of our effluent limitation guidelines. EPA's water group goes over the, you know, surface water discharge criteria on a every 2 year basis, and they look at different contaminants and different things that are in water and decide, you know, whether they're going to pursue regulation, get more information. And they've identified PFAS and landfills specifically as a category that they want more information in. So right now they're involved in actively soliciting data and looking through that with their technical teams. And so we're watching where that goes, because that could certainly have an impact on, you know, anywhere that we're dealing with liquids. Certainly leachate from landfills is a big potential impact on that piece as well. So kind of how that shakes out, what EPA chooses to do with regulations, if anything, is very much still being worked through actively as we see it today. And then I think, you know, you're looking at potential drinking water MCLs, so the maximum contaminant limits for concentrations in the drinking water. And MCLs are very specific. The regulatory process to get an MCL is not just technical, it's also economic. So by the way the program is designed, the regulators are obligated to look at both what the level is and also the cost to achieve that level. And that's not a requirement within a lot of the cleanup standards. So in a number of states, you've seen the very first regulations typically come out about groundwater cleanup targets, but they're not drinking water standards. So again, you get this sort of inconsistency that you may be obligated to clean up a monitoring well around a facility to a level that is at a certain point, but a public drinking water supply well nearby doesn't have that same framework sitting over it because the state may not have gone through the MCL process. So certainly a federal MCL, if that rolls out, you know, we'll have to tackle a lot of those technical and economic pieces head on, and might help establish a framework for the rest of the country if they're heading that way. So I think really that maybe wraps up our prepared remarks. I think really what, and we'll open it for discussion and back and forth here, but I think really what our goal is really trying to understand and reinforce what the place that, you know, a solid waste facility, a landfill, an incinerator, sludge disposal as land application, you know, how do the big we as a society view the roles of each of these waste, you know, management options? How do they come together, and sort of making sure that we're doing the research to make sure that we're informing smart decisions that enable us to either continue to use those resources as we feel they're appropriate and we're comfortable with them, or whether we want to move on to something else, and if so, you know, what's that something else? So I think we've made a lot of progress. It's not all gloom and doom in terms of where PFAS is. I think there's been a lot of research, and I think there's been a lot of good discussion. As regulators get into this space, they realize how complicated and interrelated they are, the issues can be, and we've made a lot of good progress getting that out, but certainly there's a lot more work to be done on that piece.
I guess I would just add, you know, this bullet says that, you know, continue to conduct research to fill the knowledge gaps. And certainly in our bios, it was mentioned that we're involved as individuals in EREF. Just a little plug for them, Environmental Research Education Foundation, doing a lot of work and funding a lot of research in this arena. And certainly the companies involved at this table and others of you here are involved in helping fund those activities. And there's a tremendous amount of work still to be done. And we think we've kind of targeted some of the things on Stephanie's list that there's some knowledge gaps that we still need to fill and are continuing to work that. And I think, as Joe mentioned, you know, from my personal experience, for the most part, when you can sit down with the regulator and as a regulated person and kind of say, you know, if we're going to go down this route of a ban or whatever it may be, what are the unintended consequences? And when we start to have those conversations, you kind of start to see the lights come on, and it's a reality that, well, maybe my plan of action is not the right one, and so we need to be a little more thoughtful about it. So I think, you know, while we've made progress on the research side, I think one of the kind of very difficult to measure progresses that we've found is that, you know, we've made some progress in helping to educate the regulators in this area to help them be a little more thoughtful about the unintended consequences of things. So I think, you know, we've made some progress. I think technology, there's probably a lot of you in the room that are, you know, out there trying to bring technology to bear to the market. And certainly all of us are evaluating all those things all the time because we recognize that there's a bit of uncertainty in where we're headed, and we want to try to prepare for those unknowns at this point. So I think we've made a lot of progress as a room as a whole on trying to bring forth the ability to bring things to market that help bridge some of these gaps we've identified. So for that, I'd say thank you.
I guess I would add, you know, each of us probably has a story about a particular facility where people ran around like on fire and made snap decisions. But I think we also all have stories where we had regulators who were thoughtful and worked through the issues with us hand in hand, trying to come up with good solutions. I know I've been, and I know these guys have been at conferences, and we see our regulators at these conferences learning and helping to move the industry forward. And so we still have these situations where we have bans or weird legislation that goes into place, but I think we've done a good job as an industry of being thoughtful, keeping things moving. We have, you know, from my perspective, we have treatment options that were, you know, on the page only 3 or 4 years ago, which have gotten to bench scale, which have gotten to pilot testing, and now we have successful pilot testing. And so we're seeing that move forward, which is promising. It feels like, you know, we've spent this time well, and we're moving forward. And as an industry, we're better understanding. We still have that list. We still have the knowledge gaps to understand and fill. But I certainly feel a lot better today than I did 3 or 4 years ago, trying to understand, you know, where was this going and how were we going to manage this in our facilities, you know, throughout the U.S.
I'd like to thank our speakers, panelists. Appreciate everybody's participation, and don't forget to go on the app and evaluate the session. Thank you.